All right, hello everyone, and welcome once again to the Decentralized Consciousness Podcast. Returning to the podcast today, I have Avi Burra. How are you doing, Avi?
I'm doing well, Caleb. Thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back on. Our last conversation was very, very philosophical, and I really enjoyed it. We talked about the lion in the cage versus the lion in the wild, and what happiness means. And it was quite a fun conversation. I enjoyed it a lot, and I'd recommend that anybody who hasn't heard it check that out as kind of like a preamble to this conversation here today, because at the end of that episode we said, hey, let's do it again, but this time let's go a little bit deeper and let's talk about our spirituality and what source means to each of us, our connection to source. So I think maybe I'll just leave it there, and I'll see is there anything that you kind of feel like starting with, or is there anything that just this little intro here has kind of triggered in you?
Yeah, that is an interesting question, Caleb, because it's one that can have a different answer depending on when you ask me, right? What does source mean? How do I find that sense of connection, or more importantly, the sense of meaning and purpose, right? Where do I draw that inspiration from? And, you know, maybe we'll take a step back here to, might have touched upon this in the previous conversation, but if not, I was raised, till I was 21, I grew up in India, where I was raised Hindu. And you know, my parents were not super religious. They were observant Hindus, right? But I was fortunate that both were highly educated. My mom is a pure mathematician. My dad is a quantum physicist. So I think that helped keep, to some extent, the dogmatic elements of religion out of the mix there, right? So I would say a fairly balanced introduction to spirituality growing up. Was taught that all other faiths are equally valid paths to ultimately the same goal, right, of self-realization, of finding that oneness, of leading a moral or more importantly an ethical life. It's just describing the same idea in a different language. And I'm grateful for that, because I grew up respecting these different languages, right, of expressing what that deeper connection to the universe, right? Some people call that God, right? Or but the maybe expressing the almost ineffable, if you will. So to me, you know, and then I went through my quote unquote rationalist phase in my late teens, early 20s, all the read a lot of existentialist literature, Sartre, obviously Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, lot of Joseph Heller, which is, you know, somewhat in that same ballpark. Watched a lot of the French New Wave movies, and the perhaps you could call it the arrogance of youth, if you will. I became largely atheist at that time. Having gone through various stages of life since then, becoming a father, having to raise a child, going through, I think we touched upon this in the last conversation, Caleb, my wife's near-death experience and that the adversity for 1 year almost that we went through in dealing with that incredibly uncertain and potentially incredibly tragic time. And then through finding Bitcoin itself, right? Finding, and not so much finding as going through the journey of understanding Bitcoin. I think I would say at this point, I am, maybe it's not the best word for it, but it's probably the closest word. I would call myself an agnostic. And what I mean by that is I cannot with any, I cannot definitively say that God, as is described in the majority of the organized religions, exists, right? But that's not to say I don't think there is something greater than myself, something that I can't put in words, but which I can feel and experience at times when I'm deep in meditation or deep in a flow state. Another thing I talked and mentioned in our last conversation, Caleb, was there were times when I was writing my book when I would sit down. This didn't happen a lot, but it did happen enough times to have a profound impact on me, where I'd sit down, hands on keyboard. Next thing I know, 12 pages or 20 pages even were written out, and 3 hours had passed in a blink of what felt like the blink of an eye. And it was essentially what people refer to as the flow state. And in some sense, to me, that was connecting with, for lack of a better term, with God, right? Having that almost an ego death, if you will, right? Where you lose your sense of self and you feel like, or where I felt like I was part of, I was one with the universe, right? And I had actually an incredibly profound moment well before that, when my son was born and I was in the delivery room and I happened to be, you know, standing right across. So I was the first person my son saw as he came out. And I remember staring into his eyes, and for a brief, fleeting instant, I felt like I was observing, experiencing the entirety of the universe. And it passed, right, when he started crying, or I can't remember what happened immediately after. But that one small moment, passing moment, had an incredibly profound impact on me. And that, you know, that reminds me of if you've read the Hitchhiker's Guide series, right, the second book, mm-hmm. The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, there's one section where there's, on one of the planets, there's this place called the Total Perceptive Vortex, where people walk in, and in that vortex, they see the entirety of the universe, and every single one of them dies immediately, because they cannot comprehend how minuscule they are and how infinite the universe is in comparison to them. So all of that to say that they've, in moments of meditation, in fleeting profound moments, like at the moment of the birth of my son, in times when I've been so deeply involved in creating or pursuing, let's just say, pursuing beauty, right, through art, through writing, I have experienced almost that total perceptive vortex. And that's, I know I've tried to put it into words, but I still think it's ineffable. And what I'm doing is just a poor approximation of what that experience is. So that, again, we can call this God, right? But that ineffable entity, ineffable concept, is you know, the connection, that experience with that. It's something that it's hard to describe, but I know it exists because I've experienced it. And it feels like this collective, that the entire, again, so this is another example from Hinduism, but maybe more specifically from Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, where we are all little sparks from this giant flame, right? So that the flame is the oneness of the universe, and we are but tiny little sparks, all of us. We are part of that flame, but ultimately it is, the flame is all that there is.
Beautifully said. So why does Hinduism say that the spark jumped off the flame? Does it explain why these two separate from one another?
So that's a good question. Another good question, Caleb. You know, I'd have to go back and go back to that particular metaphor and see if how that specific part is explained. But it's really, well, you know, the spark does disappear, right? And then the flame still exists.
Yeah.
So maybe it is the illusion of separation. Right? It's the spark, maybe briefly, appears to be separate from the flame, but all that there is the flame. So there is this illusion of self, meaning that the illusion of duality, right? When all that there is non-duality.
Yeah, so the models, which are ever evolving, and this is a common theme for many Bitcoiners, whether you're talking spirituality or rationality, the models that I have around separation are such that we are in like a fractalized universe. So just like that flame being in oneness, being all that there is, we are a smaller version of that, with more limitations. And the idea is that we chose to separate from all that there is to experience and forget this oneness so that we can experience it in its rawest form possible. Because it's sort of like if you're playing a video game and you figure out how to hack the game and have infinite lives or become invincible. And you find that after a time, you know, it's fun because you get to beat the game really quickly and you see these very deep levels, these places that you always wanted to go but could never get there because it's too challenging. But then over time, you're like, gosh, now I'm bored. This has just gotten too easy. And it's kind of like that in a way, where you put limitations on yourself, and the memory of who we are at our deepest core source is wiped as sort of one of these restrictions to the game itself. So we can explore ourselves even more deeply. So that's kind of my personal modeling around the spark and the flame and the separation.
Well, you know, there is another concept in Advaita Vedanta of the three realities, right? So the first level of reality is apparent reality. So these are, you could think of these as dreams or hallucinations, right? Mental imagery. So that's apparent reality. The next level is phenomenal reality or empirical reality. And that's what we're in right now, you and I, right? We're sitting on, presumably on a chair, although we're good Bitcoiners, we've sold all our chairs. we can, our five senses describe this apparent, sorry, this phenomenal reality, right? We perceive it through sense, through smell, touch, taste, hearing, and sight. So that's phenomenal reality. Now, if you think about, well, actually, let me talk about the third one. And the third one is absolute reality, which this is base level reality. So, you know, you perceive this base level reality through your senses, through these filters that you apply, right? So you have a certain image of it or a certain perception of it. I do the same, but presumably mine is a little different from yours, right? My phenomenal reality, even if you're sitting in the same room, looking at the same thing, listening to the same thing, is imperceptibly different from yours. But there is this concept of a base layer, if you will, right? This absolute reality. So that's the third level, right? That's that where you just are, right? Everyone just is. So just as you can, so this is an easy one, right? We'll take the line from The Walrus and the Carpenter. The seas are boiling hot and pigs have wings. So these are obviously images that one would see in dreams, right? And in phenomenal reality, these cannot exist. You cannot have a pig with wings, right? Or it's a very low probability event, let's just say. And the seas cannot be boiling hot. Again, very low probability, highly unlikely event. However, these constructs in apparent reality are projections from different elements that exist in phenomenal reality, right? Pigs exist, wings exist, seas exist, and the act of boiling exists in phenomenal reality. And you project these in apparent reality to create this imagery, right? So it's just as apparent reality is a projection from phenomenal reality, so is phenomenal reality a projection from absolute reality.
Wow, that's super cool.
Yeah, so one day when I figure out how to transcend my senses, Caleb, I'll let you know what absolute reality is like.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Again, in Advaita Vedanta, so Adi Shankara, who's I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's one of the sages who described, who went into detail to explain Advaita Vedanta to the masses. He said that absolute reality can only be described as what it is not. Not right, it can only be described via negativa, it cannot be described as what it is,
right? That's crazy to think, because you're basically, so the absolute reality is. So the absolute reality is the one, is not the one with the chairs, right? It's the one that's everything, or am I mixing it up?
It is the one that's everything, right? The chairs are what you right. perceive through your senses.
Yeah. What's that one called again?
That's called phenomenal reality, right? It consists the of phenomena.
Got it. And then apparent is the one where it's like a mix of the reality with the chairs, and then the one of everything.
It could be, but it's more. I would view it more as a projection. Like so, apparent reality, right? Is it's dreams. Like think of the absurdity that occurs in dreams. Mm-hmm. However, a lot of that, not a lot, all of it, that absurdity consists of different components right, that exist in some form or the other in empirical or in phenomenal reality, right? The second layer, the second level. But these are just mixed up in different ways, in absurd ways, in apparent reality. So it's a projection of constructs in phenomenal reality. And so similarly, phenomenal reality is a projection of constructs. In fact, there is just one construct. Is a projection of the construct that exists in absolute reality.
Yeah, that's mind blowing because we communicate about higher levels of spirituality effectively in kind of like apparent reality where things begin getting mixed up, but we're still limited in our ability to be able to visualize them or communicate about them based on what we understand in phenomenal reality.
Right. So here's a quick sidebar, Caleb. I tried to, obviously this can be a fairly heavy concept, right? It's not something you'd necessarily have at a beer garden, for instance. Although
maybe
I would, but probably get kicked out for doing so by everyone else. But
you've had too much. You got to go home.
Yeah, you got to go home. Exactly. I did try to inject this concept with some humor in my book. In my book 24, right, is this just to refresh folks' memory, the first book of fiction on Bitcoin, where this character, the protagonist, Oliver, is this young man who's mourning the death of his father, the sudden death of his father, premature death of his father, and then he finds out his father left him a secret, and he finds this spiritual meditative technique that allows him to access these different memories and in his mind through meditation. And one of the places he goes to is the quote unquote the time chain, where there is the keeper of the time, a guy who calls himself the keeper of the time chain, who's in fact a character from Oliver, the protagonist's childhood bedtime stories that his dad used to tell him. His name is the Nonsmeister, and the Nonsmeister explains the three realities to Oliver, but it's the Nonsmeister is like this Mad Hatter type character. So a lot of the conversations with at least I've tried to make them humorous, right? It's like Oliver asking these earnest questions, and this Mad Hatter type character, Nonsmeister, saying, "Oh, you silly goose! Don't you understand this really simple concept? You know none of this is real, right?" So, in any event, I've tried to introduce this concept through humor. And through a little bit of surrealism in my book as well.
Very cool. What's coming up for me now is I'm thinking about artificial intelligence. And if you were to ask it to form a dream or some kind of apparent reality, and what you do, I guess, you do all the time when you have it create art in the visual sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is it creating like an apparent reality within? Gosh, I'm trying to think. Because I was listening to what Bitcoin did today with NVK, and they were talking about how the way that artificial intelligence works is it effectively just through statistics will make choices as far as what it's going to say or what it's going to create based on the feedback it receives, whether it's you know, getting a response back that makes sense to it, or it's getting approval that says, yes, this image looks good. You know, there's some kind of feedback mechanism that's telling it from the human side. And it's just reiterating and reevaluating based on all of these things. So it's like, you know, human beings, we have the ability to effectively tap into base layer reality to open our minds, bring new concepts, by which then we would actually be putting, in the case of if we just continue down the thread of artificial intelligence, we would bring new concepts, I guess, from the base layer of reality. We put them into the computer, and then the computer itself then takes what we are feeding it. So, you know, unless, you know, because some people say that AI is sentient. Some people say that AI is basically communicating from, you know, as a being from this base layer reality. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure. I'm not entirely convinced by that argument, Caleb. If, in fact, I would say the Bitcoin time chain is a lot closer to base layer reality, to absolute reality, than anything that AI produces. Because by its very nature, the time chain is, for all intents and purposes, an infinite chain of the truth, right? It is the truth because, well, it's the truth because it's there, right? It sounds paradoxical, but if it wasn't the truth, it wouldn't be on the time chain. So to me, the time chain is a lot closer to base layer reality. With AI, I mean, you know, oddly enough, I don't know if you've experienced this with ChatGPT or any other large language model. That's our Grok, you know, X or Twitter has this large language model called Grok, and there are a few others. The Perplexity is another one. It reaches a point when once you press it to a certain extent, where it just starts making stuff up, right? Yeah. And that is the term of art for that, interestingly enough, is hallucination. I would think that AI at best is phenomenal reality, because all it's doing is regurgitating what it's been taught, right? And what it's been taught is what humans have fed it, and humans have fed it based on the phenomenal experience, the empirical experiences that they've had. And then every now and then AI starts hallucinating when, you know, when the wires get crossed, when it doesn't have the information. So then that's when it slips into apparent reality.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I'm kind of on your train of thought as well. I think that it has a base limitation in that its quote unquote consciousness, if you want to call it that, comes from the programmers themselves. I don't think that, at least yet anyway, it doesn't seem like anything's coming from this base layer of reality where everything is possible. But gosh, there are a lot of people that you know, that say that this is basically a sentient being, but it just doesn't seem right to me personally. Maybe I'm not convinced yet either. So
right, well, you know, a lot of people who say it want it to be one, right? So they're projecting their desires onto what they're observing.
Right. Yeah, you know, one of the most interesting ways to get into a spiritual conversation, I think, with a rational person who's at least willing to be open, or I guess an atheistic person who's willing to be open to the conversation, is to just ask them, where does life come from? Because, you know, we're able to, as a species, we are able to do insane things, from nanotechnology to cloning other live beings. But where does life come from? And every single time, life comes from life. We have, as a species, and not saying that this is impossible, I guess, but that's the one element that we have yet to figure out how to inject life into something. Because we could, it sounds like, biologically recreate, I don't even know if you could do that, but you know, you could put all of the same chemicals that go into an organism. We have the ability and the power to try to create the same thing, and we can analyze it and find, know exactly what is in any of these biological structures. But when it comes to actually creating them without the parent, we haven't been able to do it. And for me, this is where like the artificial intelligence being sentient kind of falls apart. I mean, I think they're also, and I'm curious on Hinduism's perspective on this as well, because a lot of people who are very in touch with apparent realities outside of their five senses, they say that everything is alive, that they are literally able to communicate with the consciousness that resides in the lamp or in the tree, or, you know, but these more inanimate objects that I'm referring to, apparently consciousness will literally inhabit. I don't know. This is all, I'm kind of speaking in apparent reality terms. It's like, I guess, because this is not phenomenal reality concepts, anything's possible, right?
Yeah, well, you know, that's an interesting point you raise, right? And presumably you were talking about people who are, who've taken plant medicine or psychedelics of some sort, who experience this, or people who in a very deep state of meditation too, presumably.
Exactly.
And maybe the way to think about, you know, when I describe the three realities, I don't know if you did this necessarily, Caleb, but I suspect the casual listener might say, well, you might put them out linearly, right? Where there's, well, the simplest form of reality is apparent reality, that's on the left, and then in the middle you have phenomenal reality, and then to the right you have absolute reality, right? Sort of lay them out in a line, in a linear way. But maybe it's a circle, right? Maybe there is a gap, and this is not in Hinduism, but this is just me talking out loud here, right? Maybe it's a loop, it's a closed loop, where there is some point where apparent reality connects with that that base level, base layer reality, with absolute reality, right? Because it's a circle and not a straight line.
Right. And if you can view it, if you look at it like everything is one, then you could say that each thing, if you will, so let's just say it's a lamp, because I'm looking at a lamp in the room right now. So in the reality where this lamp has been, let's say, in the apparent reality, the lamp is levitating somehow. In the phenomenal reality, the lamp is what I'm just, you know, it's the concept of a lamp. It's something you plug in the wall, it makes light. And then in the absolute reality,
there is no lamp.
There's no lamp.
Right.
Exactly. So And where was I going with this? So if you can, if we pretend like this lamp, I guess, is just like a clever marketing ploy that you see everywhere. Everything is has been given artificial intelligence now. So now this is a fancy artificial intelligence lamp. You could say that the lamp would somehow, and this is just how it would work, I guess, mechanically, to gain more knowledge, would somehow work through my consciousness as a person, as an engineer who could program it. I would then program it with the physical ones and zeros necessary, the electrons on a microchip that end up coming from absolute reality, get translated, you know, into the phenomenal reality and then put into apparent. But if it's in a sphere, yeah, I guess, or a circle, could be coming from apparent, it could be coming from absolute. I mean, it could be coming from kind of all at once. And so it could be that AI itself is, yeah, when we look at it very linearly, the electrons that are put onto, that are etched into the hard drives or into the solid state drives of the servers, it comes from human beings pushing buttons on a keyboard at the end of the day. But the energy, all of the possibilities that come in to it and come through our fingers, the physical movement, it could be coming from the other two realities as well. It could be coming from apparent or absolute.
Yeah, that is right. There's another, you know, as we're talking about this, Caleb, it struck, I just remembered, I'm sure you've seen the movie Inception.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, I love that movie. Yeah,
and the concept is somewhat similar, right? And you can have nested apparent realities, obviously, right? Dreams within dreams. I don't know if you've experienced this. I've certainly had a dream within a dream, right? And this Crazy. Is before I've and I've woken up. It's happened a couple of times to me. It's an incredible experience, right? When you wake up and you're like, wait, what just happened to me? Was was that a nested dream I had? It's happened to me a couple of times, but. The point I'm trying to get to is in Inception, it's when the act of falling gets you from one level of reality to the next real reality, right? So it's interesting that movie, Christopher Nolan, caught onto a very similar concept. I almost certain at some level he was influenced by this concept from Advaita, much like in some sense the Matrix too, right? But it's that leap, right? There is a mechanism to exit one reality. In the movie's universe, it was the act of falling or the perception of falling that caused that. How do you this goes back to, I mentioned Alice in Wonderland earlier, right? It goes and the Mad Hatter, and I think it was the Mad Hatter who at one point said, who is to say which is which? We're talking about realities, dreams versus reality.
Yeah. Yeah, I had one more thing I wanted to add, and it's escaping me at the moment.
All good, Caleb. You're in the mid leap, right? Jumping from one reality to another. That's what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I was thinking. I remember it now, and it has everything to do with memory, actually, and. I was thinking, what if this morning, let's just play around with dreams. So what if this morning was actually the very first moment that you woke up and you were implanted with all of the memories of your life up to this point, and you weren't actually alive, but you have a very vivid memory of the feelings and all of the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And you believe, you know, it because it's all basically like electronic, right? In our minds, that's what a memory is. It's just like this inner reflection. But the only thing that's actually real is, I don't know, it's what's happening now, but that's all electronic too, I guess, electrical signals too.
Yeah, that would make me very sad, Caleb, and that would it would also be terrifying. I can't remember now, in our last conversation, did I ever talk about my ego-death experience in my 20s?
Gosh, I don't remember either. Tell it again.
So I was, oddly enough, 24 years old, right? I guess there are no coincidences in life, but...
Right.
Presumably got my hands on a very, this is New York City back way before weed was legal. And I was given presumably a very toxic or just tampered with batch of weed. And I just went to a really, really bad place. By the way, I have not touched any kind of mind altering substance other than red wine since then, or you know, wow. Maybe with your, and 24 was a long time ago for me, by the way. And it just went to this incredibly dark place, and the first before it I got to the point where I am nothing. I don't exist. None of this exists. The point right before that was every single memory I have, every single experience I've had, my my parents, my life in India, because I was, you know, I was only been in the US for 3 years, my brief adventure in the US, all the magical things that I've experienced in my life were all a figment of my imagination. Wow. None of them happened. None of them are real. None of those happened. Mm-hmm. And I just felt this an infinite amount of sorrow. That's what it felt like, right? If you can, and that, so it started with this indescribable level of sorrow and sadness that this, my incredible, what I thought had been my incredible life until then, was all a figment of my imagination. And then that sorrow very, very quickly, that grief or whatever the superlative in that emotion class you can come up with, right? It immediately gave way to sheer terror. And the sheer terror was, oh my God, I don't exist. I went into this, basically everything just fell into this angry, throbbing, orange glow. And that was it. I thankfully fell asleep. And I woke up and I had 6 months of flashbacks on and off, but that's a separate story. But when you mentioned, if I'd woken up this morning and that I'd been implanted with every single memory, it just reminded me of that, because I just realized this the magnitude of sorrow and the immediately followed by terror that I felt when I thought something similar in that moment.
So then, to go a step deeper, why do you think that concept is a scary and sad one?
Well, the simple answer is I haven't transcended the phenomenal yet. And maybe I'm not ready to transcend the phenomenal. I like my life, Caleb. I like the realization I've come to is, so when I went through my nihilistic phase in life, which is I would say before being a father, but it's certainly before Bitcoin, right? Was what is the point? I'm just trapped in my senses. I have no way of transcending it. So might as well just you know, live an Epicurean life. And that just meant, you know, it was nihilistic, right? It was just, yeah, let's, you know, have a few glasses of wine and, you know, watch some really nihilistic Italian or French movie and go to bed and then wake up and do the same thing the next day. And then over and over again. I think that nihilism, I was able to reframe that, especially finding hope through hope and meaning and purpose through Bitcoin, into not, oh my God, I'm trapped in my senses, I'm a slave to my senses, and there's nothing I can do about it. That gave way to, wow, I love my senses. I love living in this body. I love being able to, you know, just experiencing this incredible beauty around me. I love having the ability to create and add to the beauty that's around me. So what if I can't transcend? That's when it happens. If it happens, it happens. But until then, I'm just going to enjoy this incredible sensual human experience that I'm in right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super cool. And that's a very cool ego death story. Because what I was going to say is that it has something to do with attachment or almost taking life too seriously. Because, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, or I guess the end of the century, let's say, there's going to be very, very few people that even, you know your name or remember who you are or what you did. And, you know, from a very practical, from even in the most practical of perspectives, it's like, yeah, what are you here to do? Are you here to satisfy that ego? Are you here to dominate and control the world and accumulate?
I've come to the realization, Caleb, that I'm here to pursue beauty, right? Mm-hmm. Whether in other people's eyes, other people's perception, I might not be creating beauty, but that's right. But set that aside for a second. From my perspective, is the pursuit of beauty. That's right. What is the meaning of life? The meaning of life is to live. But what is living? Living is accepting that you are in this meat sack, right? And you have five, I guess, empirical senses, and maybe a few higher order senses, right? The emotions and so on. But that's who you are. That's what you're in control of. You're certainly in control of your thoughts, and your thoughts control your emotions, and your between the thoughts and emotions, you control your reality. So purpose of life is to live. Living is the unbridled pursuit of beauty. And then where ethics come in is ensuring that your pursuit of beauty doesn't interfere with any other human being's pursuit of beauty. And that's it. That's I found, now I'm making it sound like life is easy, right? And life is easy, but but I'm not, you know, I do find my, there are, it's not like I do this, I'm an expert and I practice this day in and day out. And, you know, right, there are moments when I have to stop myself. I catch myself becoming unaligned from this state of being. And I have to either have a conversation with my wife as a sounding board, or just find some quiet space to meditate. Sometimes, you know, those moments when I'm unaligned last for a few days. But eventually, I mean, I know that that too will pass, right? The quickest way of it passing is accepting where you are. I mean, truly accepting and surrendering. where you are. And then once that washes over you, hopefully some inspiration springs from there. But to the extent that I can, I try and follow these principles. I'm here to pursue beauty, right? And happiness is a byproduct of that. It's not the end goal, it's just a byproduct of that pursuit of beauty. And I make sure that I don't interfere with anyone else's pursuit of beauty.
Yeah, I love the fact that the word beauty is it's a very subjective concept too, because beauty is completely unique to every individual and also dependent on at what point the individual is observing that beauty or experiencing that beauty. So, you know, back when you were a 24-year-old, before you had your ego death, the pursuit of beauty to you was something very, very different than when you were 25 and after you let go of what you thought to be beauty at that time. And because we are all coming from the same flame and we're just experiencing everything in a very different way, you know, for me, the pursuit of beauty doesn't feel like, you know, accumulating a bunch of stuff and power and control, but I'm more aligned with the ethos of the Bitcoiner and the story of the Bitcoiner who is fighting for what they believe in, standing up for what they believe in, and in believing in empowering other people and guiding through an authentic form of leadership that gives way for a level of transparency and vulnerability as the leader to say, hey, I'm just doing my best to put myself out there authentically. And what I mean by that is I'm just following my fulfillment or my beauty, as you're saying. I'm just trying to find my beauty. And in doing so, I hope that it inspires you. And if I can be in any help to help you do that, by all means, but also I need your help too. And see, like, to me, that's a very beautiful journey. And this whole story of coming from a world which is so powerfully and deeply controlled by this different kind of beauty, the fiat kind of beauty, I guess, the story of a revolution from that to what I just described is also, I think, a very, very beautiful story too.
Yeah, for sure. I want to go back to something you said about not wanting to pursue, I'm paraphrasing what you said, Caleb, but not wanting to pursue power, right? Yeah. Or accumulate power. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the word power, it cannot exist in a vacuum, meaning it cannot be a concept that only exists for one person, right?
Right.
In other words, a person has power. When they say they have power, they mean they have power over someone else, right? Either one other person or a group of other people, right? In some way, shape, or form. And I think this goes back to what I was saying, where ethics come in this pursuit of beauty, which is I make sure that my pursuit of beauty doesn't interfere with anyone else's pursuit of beauty. And if I have, even in the other person's perception, power over them, right, if I've created the conditions where they have this perception, then I am interfering with their pursuit of beauty. So I don't think Pao fits into. I'm agreeing with what you said here, right? I don't think Pao fits into this dynamic.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you brought that up, because in the, especially in our decentralized consciousness facilitators group, who've been practicing as people who kind of who are trying to hold space to for healing other people, we've been trying to figure out what leadership looks like in a decentralized way, because what we want really more than anything is we want people to self-empower. We want people to step up and create from their authentic selves to, and what I mean by that is to, well, I mean, it can mean an infinite number of things, but I think probably the most common example is to step away, step out of fear, to be able to release your fears, or at least see your fears for what they are, and then work with them to then get to what is the base, what is the, you know, at your core, what is it that you want to be pursuing? And I think that we as a group really want people to do that. And it's not because, it's not coming from the old paradigm, right? It can't be, because self-empowerment is would mean less power for me. It's more self-empowerment of the other. It means more power for me. So it's still, it's, I guess in a way, I guess you could look at it like I am, we are pursuing more power, but we're doing it knowing that the more empowered everyone else is, the more powerful that I can become too. And that has a
That's
huge,
right.
huge, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I just noticed there's a parallel there with Bitcoin as well, right? Because of the decentralized nature, and because all of us have our stakeholders, right, in a small piece of the protocol. If someone you don't even know, right, contributes to the protocol in a positive way, it has a incrementally positive impact on the protocol, and the value, the purchasing power that you have increases incrementally as well, right? It's just the concept of the rising tide, and it's the same with Nostr as well, right? It's because it's a decentralized protocol. Everyone's positive contribution to the protocol not just helps them, but it also helps the other folks who are using the protocol, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and this is, yeah, this is something that the people in the fiat paradigm have such a hard time understanding, because I want to explain to them that value doesn't have to come from the top down. It doesn't have to come from the government saying, this is what we are all going to value. And I mean, at the end of the day, we know that that's not what's happening. We know that it's, we think that's what that's happening and that's causing it to happen. But it's really us that's choosing to value this money. And then, yeah, the enforcement mechanism in Bitcoin basically being self-fulfilling, which means that if I take away another's power, I'm taking away my own. You know, and
Right.
vice versa. If I empower another person, I'm empowering myself.
Yeah.
And
Well, By the way, Caleb, I just realized I missed an opportunity to do a nice tie back to the to where we started. Instead of saying a rising tide lifts all boats, I could have said a growing flame lifts all sparks.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Anything else coming up for you right now?
No, I think this is, with that tie back in, into the flame, it feels like we've come full circle.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, this has been a very wild ride. I really appreciate you coming back on to go even deeper. It's been a lot of fun. So
yeah, I think I enjoyed this conversation even more than the last one. Last one was fun, but this is more fun.
Same, definitely, which is what you hope for, right? That's what you hope for in life in general, I guess, is to just continue expanding, continue growing, stretching the edges of what's possible, and stretching the apparent reality, I guess, too.
Or to take that leap from your level of reality and hope to reach base layer.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, Avi, before I end the recording, can you just remind everybody where they can find you and how they can get your book?
Sure, yeah. To get my book, you can just go to Amazon, type in Avi Burra and the number 24. The name of my book is 24, and then it should show up. If not, I'll give you my Nosta and Twitter contacts. You can reach out to me on DM. My DMs are open on both. Well, Nosta DMs are always open. We're happy to do an OTC trade for the ebook with you. So on Nosta, the easiest way is go to primal.net/Avi, A-V-I, and that'll take you to my profile. And on Twitter or X, I am at Avi_Burra, B-U-R-R-A.
Got it. All right. Well, thanks again, Avi. And we might have to schedule another one. Just keep going. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. One more thing. Sorry, Caleb.
Yes, go ahead.
And if you are using, any podcasting platform, but if you're using Fountain app, which is, by the way, is going to be a Nosta client very soon in the next few weeks.
Really?
Yeah. I'm actually beta testing the test flight version. It's coming up. It's looking very promising. So you can post Nosta notes, and all the Fountain social events are basically become Fountain events. It's pretty cool. So in any case, if you're using Fountain or any other podcasting app, you can find my weekly podcast, mostly focused on Nosta and Bitcoin culture. It's called Pleb Chain Radio.
Got it. Avi, thank you again for coming on, and I look forward to doing the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Caleb.